Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Munch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Glad to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies. What the Golden Globes lacks in diversity, it makes up for in corruption, according to a scathing expose in the Los Angeles Times. Sure, the headline here is that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is the group that puts on the Golden Globes every year, has no black members. Though I can't imagine anyone who has paid any attention to the Globes is shocked by this fact, given the nominees in any given year. The real corruption has to do with what can only be described as bribes given to members of the HFPA to support certain projects. Sure, and all expenses paid trip to France, resulting in a spate of nominations for the widely loathed Emily in Paris, might look corrupt, but sorry, I forgot where I was going with this. On top of all that, the members of the HFPA are racking up huge payments from the HFPA, turning the nonprofit into a veritable cash cow for members. $2,300 a month to be on the travel committee. $3,465 to two dozen members to watch some foreign films. These are substantial sums of money to struggling journalists, and that's not all of them. There were a whole bunch of these. Such corruption is par for the course in the world of the award season, though. I mean, Collider's Steven Weintraub blithely tweeted out a gift basket he had received from Searchlight on behalf of Nomadland. And while it was fun to dunk on him and the studio for the tastelessness of sending journalists pricey treats to celebrate a movie that is at least in part about homelessness and poverty, there's nothing particularly unusual about it. I myself receive enormous, huge, giant coffee table books from Netflix every year. And not wanting to throw them away, I just put them in my library and use them as decorations, so I appear learned and wise. Peter, what's the best bit of swag you've ever received?
I mean, I've gotten so little swag over the years. I've actually turned down a lot. When the first Transformers film came out in, I want to say 2007, I got this great little box. Not little box. It was like a double sized shoebox with a really big Optimus Prime toy that still sits on my windowsill. In my office next to like all of my childhood Star Trek and Star Wars toys. I like Transformers. The toy didn't influence. Actually, no. The only reason I liked that movie was because of the toy.
I knew it.
I think, look, so
corruption.
I do think that the gift swag situation deserves to be at least more transparent in some ways, right? Like, so you have argued kind of, I think tongue-in-cheek, I'm not sure ever with you, Sonny, that like, that on the one hand, people shouldn't get swag, but if they get it, they should shut up about it. I actually think we should know. And this is the thing, is like, it should be really clear what the studios are doing and what they're not doing and who's getting stuff that's worth quite a bit. I was offered not too long ago a significant gift card to get Uber Eats or something like it while watching a screener of a movie, right? And it is, you know, it doesn't come with any expectations attached, right? You don't have to write a positive review of the film that they're pitching you. You don't have to do any of that sort of thing, right? You don't even have to necessarily comment on the film at all. You can just watch the movie and take the gift card and have a nice dinner in on the studio. But I kind of think that you shouldn't do that sort of thing. And to the extent you can turn this stuff down, sometimes it just arrives in your box, right, in your mailbox, and you're like, well, what? There's no way to return it, right? But to the extent you can turn this stuff down, you should. And to the extent that it's being sent to you and you're reviewing the films in general, you ought to try and let people know. And frankly, and not that studios are PR machines, they have no responsibility to be transparent about this stuff, no obligation. At the same time, it would be nice to know who is getting all of these rewards and that sort of thing. I just think there's a weird kind of greasing of critical opinions and influence that goes on behind the scenes that I think a lot of people just don't know about.
Well, and amazingly enough, I know some critics who post, you know, over the last year, I've been like posting the meals that they've been getting to watch with screeners on Facebook. So it's like, completely blithely, it's like almost weird. I mean, I think part of what I find strange about the transparency is that there are at least some people who don't seem to understand that they're being bribed.
Well, I'm sorry, Alyssa. I want to highlight this point because it kind of is in resonance with something that Peter mentioned earlier. I did tweet about this Collider guy. You shouldn't do this. You shouldn't accept these things. And if you do, you definitely shouldn't brag about them. And I wasn't being tongue in cheek. I was just making the point that, like, if you're going to sit there and, like, take stuff from the studios, don't just be like, hey, look at all this stuff I got to tweet about Nomadland, because it's like embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's not it's just embarrassing. Right. Unless, I mean, like you say, they're blithely unaware that they're being bribed. But it's what it is.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, I get various stuff that shows up at the house or at the office in the before times. Because I'm a member of the Television Critics Association, I get basically no movie swag, in part because, you know, I'm a columnist, and so I guess I don't count as a reviewer in a way that people care about. And a lot of it is just like, here's, like, at this point, a fairly stale popcorn snack mix, or here's a thing full of nuts that would kill you if you ate it. I will confess to keeping the coffee mugs, in part because some of them are really good.
The nuts are not actually poisonous to normal people, people with nut allergies. To be clear, they're not actually sending out bags full of murder nuts on purpose.
Yes. And that would be a whole different kind of screwed up. That would actually make
Blumhouse would do well if they killed a critic or two with the murder nuts.
That would be kind of hilarious. Now I'm like,
no, it wouldn't be. Murder is bad, but
this is the assistant, like, part two, the assistanting, where an assistant starts killing off high profile critics. Never mind. But yeah, the Washington Post, where I work, has a strict rule on accepting these things, which means there's a system for, like, giving away swag that, like, people buy at the end of the year, and then the proceeds are given to charity. And the recognition is, like, you know, it's embarrassing for companies to think that they can buy you off with, like, a bottle of booze or something. Like, you should have more self-worth than that. I thought the LA Times piece about the Hollywood Foreign Press Association made the interesting point, though, that some of the reason this has happened is because the overseas, film press has been really financially devastated. And I think that's true in the U.S., too. I think a lot of the people who are getting these swag things are freelancers who, frankly, in some cases could, like, they accept the stuff because they need the money or because it's, like, a way to get a nice dinner. And that's, you know, that's sort of a sad statement on the state of film journalism and criticism, but it doesn't make it not corrupt.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference here, I think, between a critic getting a print or a giant Transformers figure or whatever, and what we're seeing with the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is kind of a more rigorous and institutionalized form of bribery, like actual people are actually getting money from the HFPA, and the way they raise that money is by, you know, selling TV rights and all that, right? And so the Emily in Paris thing is, like, kind of the most shocking one, because everyone was like, how did this movie get nominated for, or how did this TV show get nominated for anything at the Golden Globes? And it turns out, well, there was a big junket to Paris to see the movie. And of course the movie, or the show, ends, I keep calling it a movie because I haven't watched it, because I would never watch it because it looks terrible. And yet here it is, Golden Globe nominee. But the problem here, you know, is that, again, there is no institutionalized norm that critics have that say we cannot accept money or goods or whatever from these organizations. I find it all very unseemly. Like, I don't want to go full Gamergate here, but it really is about ethics in film criticism, and it's bad. It makes us all look bad.
So yeah, Alyssa mentioned something that I think is just worth highlighting, which is you work for the Washington Post, and the Post has ethics rules, and part of what is happening here is that studios are, exploiting is probably too strong a word, but making use of the fact that a lot of critics are now online working for relatively new, relatively small startup publications that don't have a kind of legacy of journalistic ethics. that they adhere to, right? That, and even if they've been around for 10 years or something, and even if they have pretty wide reach on the internet and get really quite well read, a lot of these places are just sort of like, they assume that everybody who's going to be writing about this stuff is going to be getting swag as part of the job. And I think that that is sort of what's destructive here, is just that there are all of these kind of, it's not that I'm against startup critics on the internet, people blogging, people writing on Substack, people writing on, you know, on what are you building their own websites and getting readers. That's great. I think independent journalism is wonderful. And we need more of it, frankly. But when it is built on this sort of model where part of the compensation implicitly is that you just sort of are constantly showered in like in swag, and not just swag, trips. We don't have these trips happening this year, obviously.
Although it's interesting that the bunch of Paris junkets, one, right? Must have happened,
yeah,
during the pandemic.
I don't know for certain, but like certainly in pre-pandemic,
yeah,
the junket business and the junket traffic, right? You weren't being given an object, you were just being flown to Los Angeles, yeah, to see a movie and talk with the stars and like, yeah, hobnob with the people who made stuff and like get to see the cool cars from the set. And like, yeah, all of this was funded by the studios in a way that is not necessarily, like some places would disclose it, but it would be not necessarily transparent at all to readers.
And it's worth saying that I think it is in Hollywood's interest not to have a strongly respected independent body of critics who are taken seriously, right? Like the long-term goal here is obviously to turn critics into sort of adjuncts of the studio publicity machines. And so, you know, doing something like this both makes critics sort of potentially beholden to the studios and undermines the idea that critics are doing sort of serious independent journalism. And so, you know, this is a form of corruption that works for the studios, not just in the sense that they get good reviews or, you know, Golden Globe nominations for Emily in Paris, but a sort of gutted body of independent observers who have any power over their stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I like Peter mentions the trips and the, you know, the big one that nobody really likes to talk about are the superhero movies, the, you know, the Marvel movies in particular. The reason you see all these stories on, you know, the fan sites and the nerd blogs and stuff about, well, oh, here's some footage from my exclusive set visit to, you know, but is because they want all of the nerd blogs to be cheering the release of this new movie, and they want to have, Even if it's just implicit and not explicit, they want to have a check on the reviews. Because I guarantee you, if you're out there savaging, you know, Captain Marvel or Avengers Endgame or whatever, your leash is going to be pretty short on the next junket to, you know, Hawaii to talk to Robert Downey Jr. for 5 minutes while his minders tap their watch and say, "Come on, we got to get a move on here."
So I know your fave, Sonny, hosted a whole bunch of like bloggery journal, sort of movie journal types for Dawn of Justice, I think it was, or maybe, yeah, it was not Justice League. It was Superman versus Batman, right? And there was this like wave of coverage in which everybody had the same photo of themselves sitting in front of the new Batmobile or in mm-hmm. In the Batcave or whatever. And a few of the folks were like, yeah, they paid for me to fly to London. Like, this was all on the studio dime. I mean, like, there were some descriptions of it that I thought were like, okay, this is, like, you're getting access to something that is actually valuable to your readers. And I don't think it's, you should necessarily turn this down.
I'm sorry. Is a backstage visit to Batman versus Superman: Dawn of Justice,
I think, even
actually useful for the,
I will actually defend this.
Wait, let me finish because I don't think it's actually useful for the readers in any sense of the imagination. What good is this doing them? What it is publicity for the studio. It's clicks for the website. What does the reader actually get about this? They already know that the movie is coming. They like, I don't see what the value added here is.
I mean, I think it's clear that there is reader interest in seeing and hearing about the production and the design aspects and some of the stories that come out of this sort of thing. And I also think that there is journalistic value in having contact with the actual players who are making the movie, even if it, and if this is the only way you can do it, in the same way that while it's like, it would be very bad if journalists, if political journalists were constantly just taking really fancy gift baskets from senators. But a thing that happens is that outside groups will sponsor dinners, right? And so a nonprofit will say, set up a dinner with a senator and a bunch of journalists from a number of different outlets. And then, and nobody's paying, I mean, the outside group is paying for that dinner, and you get to go and you get to grill the senator and you get some close-up access in a way that you might not get otherwise. And that is, that creates value for your coverage and for your publication. And there's, right? And so, again, you know, this sort of thing is, I think it's a little more complicated, maybe even than we're making it here. At the same time, I got the organic carrots basket for Nomadland. Like, yeah. that's not my favorite promotion.
Yeah. And that one, I think, stood out to people because it was so sort of tasteless and off message. But all of this stuff is bad, and it's corrosive for film journalism. I mean, the answer to this is, you know, better jobs or clearer career paths for critics, not everyone living off swag.
I guess we should also probably just say, like, all of us have seen a lot of movies for free, and that's pretty clear. Well, and this is, but this is again sort of what I'm saying is different, is like, you to some extent, you are at the mercy of, like, to sometimes the only way to get the access you need to write about the film, right, which is, or write about the making of the film, is to do so with studio guidance and minders. But you got to be clear about how that is happening and about the transaction that's going on there.
Right, right.
And I mean, like, these totally unrelated gifts are what really bother me.
Yes. Right. I mean, this is the thing, right? Is that, like, critics get to go to press screenings, right? And sometimes those are open to members of the public and sometimes they're not. Critics, at least in the critics groups, get screener DVDs at the end of the year for award season, right? And, like, okay, you need to get the movie so you can watch the movie so you can decide whether or not you want to include it. Fine. Sometimes you get a screenplay, right? Okay, well, you need the screenplay to read the screenplay to see if you want to put it in best screenplay or not, right? But then there's like an escalating series of these things. Like, okay, what about the hardcover art book? Well, surely you need to see what the production design was like, right? You know, what about the soundtrack CD? Well, you want to listen to the soundtrack, et cetera, et cetera. I just, like, again, I like, there are a lot of things that you can excuse. I would say that, anything that does not actually contribute to your understanding of the picture to vote on in whatever categories is probably beyond the pale. All right, what do we think? Is the habit of giving journos bags of swag during award season a controversy or a non-controversy? Alyssa?
It's a controversy.
Peter?
Controversy, but a little more complicated than that sounds.
No, it's definitely a controversy, and this has to stop, as the Supreme Court is fond of saying. It's not necessarily corruption, but the appearance of corruption that is the issue. And as Peter says, you know, like, imagine if political reporters were just getting bags of goodies from senators. We'd all be pissed off, and we'd be right to be pissed off. So, yeah, controversy. If you enjoyed this show, which is not controversial, it's hard-hitting ethics and film criticism work, make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we'll have a bonus members-only episode about the return of Brett Ratner, who had been exiled from Hollywood's good graces for his behavior with women. Is Me Too over? Now, on to the main event. Nomadland, this year's award season darling, is available on Hulu now. If you can't make it to an IMAX screen to enjoy the wide western vistas shot by director Chloe Zhao and cinematographer Joshua James Richards, Nomadland follows Fern, played by Frances McDormand, as she sets out on a nomadic life, following the collapse of a gypsum plant in Nevada, and the resultant death of the town in which it was located. She is living out of a van and doing odd jobs in order to stay afloat. She travels where the work is, to an Amazon fulfillment center during the holiday season, at rock stands and burger joints elsewhere as the year goes on, and takes in the beauty of the country. The beauty of the country is very much part of the point of this film. Zhao and Richards seem to have worked mostly during the golden hour, framing the faces of their subjects with a sort of pinkish-purplish hue, a sheen provided by the sun, the sky, and the clouds. This is God's country. But there are some who believe this is a movie about people who have been abandoned by God, left to the vicissitudes and the predations of capitalism. I would argue that it is to Zhao's credit that this movie is not a didactic exercise in the evils of the neoliberal order. Vern is happy in the Amazon warehouse, or at least as happy as one can be in kind of meaningless, mindless labor, making friends and making money. Indeed, she is distraught when the need for her labor ends. She's a person who wants to work. She finds working useful. She finds meaning in it. And there are people who live this life by choice, packing their worlds into a van and traveling the highways and the byways in order to see the country and live untethered from property and land. My friend Chris Moody, formerly of Vice, is one such. And his piece in Outside Magazine about this movie is a must-read to understand the difference between those who choose this life and those who have this life thrust upon them. A subtle critique of the tenuousness of capitalism is, by necessity, baked into every fiber of this film. When Fern can't afford to repair her van, she's forced to take a bus to a relative's house to get cash to fix it, and endure a lecture about her lifestyle, just to get back on a bus to get back and get her van again. It's a complex movie, and that's what I like about it. It doesn't hold your hand and tell you what you need to think. I don't know that the whole thing works, but I think that specific part of it, the political part of it, is actually quite good. Alyssa, what did you make of Nomadland?
Well, since we've just had a discussion about ethics in film criticism, and we're talking about the sort of Amazon subplot of Nomadland, it's worth disclosing that all three of us are in the pay of Dark Lord Jeff Bezos. I obviously work at The Post, which he owns. Peter's wife works with me in the opinion section, and Sunny is a contributing columnist to The Post opinion section. So none of us, our hands are not clean.
Take everything that comes next with a grain of salt, yes. In other words.
But I loved this movie, and I think that the folks who want it to be a sort of miserable, you know, didactic look at the evils of capitalism and seasonal employment are sort of missing something. And I think that one thing I've been thinking about a lot over the past year is an argument that conservatives have made and that I think liberals have kind of shrugged off to a certain extent, which is that, you know, it actually is good for people to work and to be connected to institutions. And that, you know, the pandemic has taken a lot of that away from people. It's taken church. It's taken, you know, like your bowling league, if you had one. It's taken, you know, your kids' little league games where you could hang out with people in the stands. It, for a lot of Americans, it has taken their ability to have a job at all or their ability to go to a workplace where they find meaning.
In particular, for low-income workers, the class of people who have been hit hardest job-wise are relatively young, relatively low-skilled workers making less than $50,000 a year.
And it seems likely that their jobs will be the slowest to come back if they come back at all. And I think liberals have, to a certain extent, underestimated the importance of those ties. You know, the idea of a universal basic income has gained a lot of credence on the left. You know, Ezra Klein had an interesting column about sort of whether work is actually dignified and whether that's something that Americans tend to fetishize. And I think that Nomadland is a movie that kind of pushes back against that assumption. There is real dignity in having a job, even if it's a job that's difficult, even if it's a job that, you know, is not particularly intellectually stimulating or dramatic. There is, you know, sort of real importance and dignity to, you know, making sure you have that $2,300 on hand if your van breaks down. And being cut adrift is not a great thing, right? I mean, there's a reason that part of Fern's arc in the movie is, you know, going from being someone who is relatively rootless, literally. I mean, her community has disappeared, her husband has died, and she's initially someone who sort of rejects the idea that she's going to belong in this community of people who live in their vans and work seasonally. She's reluctant to go to this gathering, but she ends up finding this community that, even as it's in flux and far-flung, is, you know, durable and creative and interesting and has a lot to offer her. And I think, you know, this is a movie that is not neatly partisan, but it does the political work that I think art can do best, which is say something that doesn't fit neatly into the partisan divide. It's not a movie about how Amazon and its warehouses are evil. You know, and it's Amazon, like, let them into the warehouses to film in part because they just adopted a $15 minimum wage. Like, Amazon does, you know, is running a game here. But it's not a movie about how Amazon is neatly evil. It's not a movie about how gig work is good. It's not a movie about that sort of neatly valorizes Fern as like a free spirit. It makes pretty clear that a lot of the people who have, you know, who are in her path, you know, either this is not necessarily the retirement they would have chosen, but they're making something interesting out of it, or, you know, they are adrift in some way and need to be rooted. But it's much more interesting for not being neat. And it advances a lot of ideas that are just not particularly part of the mainstream political conversation. But that doesn't make it not political.
Peter, what did you make of the choice to use a lot of real people in this movie as opposed to simply having actors? I mean, there are actors, of course. But
I mean, so in some ways, this is unusual in that it is... more so than Chloe Zhao's previous films, this actually is a little bit more structured and has a little more of a kind of clearly directed narrative with two well-known professional actors at the center of it. And if you've seen Songs My Brothers Taught Me or The Writer, they make even heavier use of what she is calling first-time actors, first-time performers, people who don't have any background in acting and probably in most cases will not end up acting again. I found it kind of fascinating, and I thought that part of the movie's excellence came from the way that she used those people. Because she was using real people, I think she felt obligated in some sense to be decent to them in a way that you sometimes don't see in movies, certainly movies with this sort of subject matter. And I just found this film profoundly moving in a way that it's almost hard to explain, and I rarely find myself sort of just searching for words to say how much I loved a film in it, but I am. That's how I feel after watching this and just thinking about it, and I can't wait to go back and watch this again and again. Alyssa said a lot, and I largely agree with what Alyssa said about sort of the movie's social and political context, but what actually, you know, so the other thing that stuck out to me and what I think is notable is the movie's its moviness, for lack of a better word, right? In some ways this sort of feels just like a kind of a documentary. It feels really raw. It feels, you know, it's shot in golden hour, but it's not one of these sort of big, heavily produced films like her next film, a Marvel movie, Eternals, right, which is going to be, you know, $150 million Angelina Jolie film. And yet, this movie is so deeply in conversation with 100 years of Hollywood, and in particular with the Western, and with the myth of the West that was created in the Western, and also the way that the myth of the West has just sort of seeped into American character, and the ways that it sort of, on the one hand, suggests, you know, boundless personal freedom, and also when you get there, feels real empty. And I just loved looking at this movie in a way that I just almost can't describe. I just was overcome by it, and it is literally the only thing that annoyed me about this movie is that it is a 2021 film that we're supposed to treat as a 2020 movie, and that's it. It's like, if this absolutely would have been far and away the best thing I saw in 2020 if I'd seen it last year. And I'm heartened actually by the fact that it appears to be leading the best picture category for, you know, or the it's not been nominated yet, but it appears to be leading in the sort of stakes for the best picture for Oscars.
Yeah, no, I am with you on just the sort of physical beauty of the movie. And I think it's, you know, especially after watching it you know, after almost exactly a year in my house. Really, I grew up, I don't know if you guys did this too, but I grew up going to a lot of national parks as a kid, and spending a lot of time in the American Southwest with my parents in particular. And man, it's just a reminder of how physically gorgeous America is.
Also, how great how wonderful it is to see a camera pick up real things in the real world. Yeah. Right. And so blockbusters these days are just so heavily green screened products, right? Or built or on sets, right? And there is, I'm pretty sure, not a single shot in this movie that isn't in a real place, right? So some of the sets were clearly dressed. There's a credit for like a set decorator or set costumer or something like that. But these places are, they look like real places, and yet they're not. They somehow or another, she just captures something in them that's beyond real, right? That's sort of, yep, like she's both saying this is real, it's ordinary. Sometimes in certain ways it's ugly, but in its sort of ordinary ugliness, right? Trailer parks and places just filled with trash, honestly, on the grounds. No, there is something really deeply beautiful about them, and I was just moved beyond words by this film. And I still am thinking about it.
I will say that my big complaint about this movie is that I do think that it is a character study in the kind of worst sense of the word, which is that it is slightly plotless. It is slightly meandering. It's not. It has kind of a. The filmmaker who comes to mind, the two filmmakers who come to mind when I was watching this, the first was Terrence Malick, of course, because of the obsession with the Golden Hour. But also there's a little bit of Antonioni in here, just kind of the ennui of the open road and the, you know, the aimlessness of it all, which I need more stuff to happen, which sounds a little bit pedestrian. But I do kind of need like an actual arc that is more than just, you know, we're out here on the road, we're doing our thing. And then we're gonna come back, and it's now we're gonna stay on the road, and then that's
but the
that's
arc
it.
Is that she's trying to figure out what her arc is gonna be. The arc
right,
is that
that's,
she
that's
is
not an arc.
Is that she is looking for purpose, and it is this is a movie about the search for meaning in life, and the
sure.
way that meaning is. Meaning can be found, but it's always illusory, and it's always in this weird combination of choice and circumstance that is thrust upon you, and community, right? And when you
right.
And when those three and meaning comes from those three things, and yet never quite find it, right?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
okay, Sonny. We know you have no soul.
As I said, it reminds me of Antonioni. You basically described La Ventura. It's fine. I don't know. I like this movie a lot, and I like it more because I find the conversation around it so dumb, as weird as that is to say, and as weird as that sounds. Like I like.
It's a very
like
sunny
fact,
bunch.
I like the fact that like dumb people are flummoxed by this movie in a way that, you know, gets them to commit to their dumbness. Like if your main response to this film is like, well, it should have been more condemnatory of the things I hate. And you can't actually see the condemnation of the things that you hate within the movie. You're really telling on yourself, as the kids say. I don't know. So Alyssa, you said you love the kind of natural beauty of the West and all that. Did this call to mind childhood trips for you? Was this a
yeah, absolutely.
Was this a like I mean, obviously your folks weren't like going from Amazon warehouse to Amazon warehouse,
yes,
but like
No. We were flying into various places and going hiking. Yeah, I mean, I think that as a kid there's something very interesting about going to the West, especially if you grew up in New England, as I did, because you just feel so small in a way that the landscape of New England never really does for you. I mean, you know, the Green Mountains are mountains, but there's just something very different about going and hiking the Tetons, or even you like hiking down into Canyon de Chelly, or, you know, just driving through Monument Valley and being like, you know, you get a sense of your littleness as a kid in those spaces. And it's, you know, it can be kind of scary, but it's also amazing. I mean, just seeing that the world is weirder and more variegated and harsher than anything you've experienced, I think is a really remarkable experience. And it's something I'm looking forward to doing as a parent myself. It's just, and I think that's true sort of no matter where you grow up, going someplace else and just seeing a totally different sky and landscape is a really profound experience. And I thought the movie captured that really well. I mean, that, you know, the scene in the national park where, you know, Fern and Dave are sort of flirting over the tour, but they're also doing it in this totally alien landscape. So you're having this incredibly sort of human, gentle, even tentative experience in this.
It's like raw, a set for the Eternals.
Yeah, this raw, racked rock formation.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, we're small and vulnerable even when we're not living in vans. And I think that's some of the appeal of Western storytelling. I mean, it's very interesting to me that, you know, Zhao is a, you know, Chinese-born director, and a Chinese-born director from a background of, you know, fairly considerable privilege, who has come to the U.S. and gotten really interested in Western landscapes and the people who occupy them. And in a way, the movie that this made me think of a little bit was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which has its wonderful sort of backstory set in China's Western provinces, and is also a movie that's sort of about testing yourself and finding who you are in the desert and finding that you are sort of gentler and more willing to accept help in community than you had expected. And I think that's why, you know, that's part of the reason that American Westerns, you know, were incredibly interesting to directors in Italy and now in China. You know, there is something universal about kind of testing yourself against that kind of landscape and feeling your smallness, and learning to be at peace with that smallness and not afraid of it.
I mean, I think part of the reason that all of that works so well is Frances McDormand, who is the vehicle through which we see and experience that world. And she's just a marvel, right? Like, and it's so strange to have been watching her now, like, for like 25 years, 30 years, right? I mean, like, in Coen Brothers films and, you know, sort of eventually in other stuff, and just see this, to just see her, like, kind of act circles around everyone in Hollywood for 2.5, 3 decades, whatever it is. I mean, I don't remember what her first credit is. The first time I encountered her was in Fargo, you know, in the 1990s. Yeah. But just to see how good she is and how good she still is, maybe even better, right? It's just kind of amazing. You mentioned Crouching Tiger, Alyssa, mm-hmm. And I actually wanted to ask both of you. It almost struck me that this movie is directed, Zhao's shooting the American West like China, right? And if you sort of think of the way that when you see kind of natural wonder in Chinese films, you see, right, it's always these sort of big sweeping mountains and like vast landscapes, but like a lot of transitional stuff too, right, where you'll see, you know, snow caps and deserts kind of right next to each other and this stuff, right, and this sort of, there's this mythic sensibility about it that is great. Like, it's just visually stunning, right? That is part of, you know, the language of Chinese cinema. And like, somehow or another, in this like relatively low budget, almost cinema verite kind of way, she is bringing that eye for landscape to the American West in a way that I just find incredibly powerful.
I want to loop back to what you said about McDormand, because, I mean, the range of what she can do is so extraordinary, right? I mean, in the Coen Brothers movies and in Wes Anderson films, she often plays these sort of exaggerated, mannered characters, and she's so hyper-natural here. But her career is also a testament just to the value of having actors who look like human beings, yeah, instead of like people who were 3D printed to meet, you know, very normative standards of beauty. Like,
speaking of Angelina Jolie, who, I mean, is a great actress, but like, yes, I have been in a room with her, and she appears to be an alien. She does. She seems in. If you are physically 4 feet from her, she seems as if she is computer generated.
Yeah, and I mean, the virtue of having actors who look like actual human beings is considerable. And you could not do this movie. Like, there is no world in which, like, Michelle Pfeiffer does this movie and it works at all, right? Like, you know, actress of roughly similar age and, like,
who's a great actress.
Breath.
It's,
yes,
not, because,
and great
it's
actress,
not because she's a,
like,
bad actress.
No,
it's because,
not at all.
Hey, to go back to it, like, an old theme of ours, casting
choices. Yeah,
are you choices,
saying it matters?
Casting
it matters
choices
what
matter.
Sort of person is cast in a movie? Yeah, yes. I don't know. It's weird, huh? It's weird how that happens to be the case. I mean, obviously Margot Robbie would have been better as Fern. you know, just because she's so much hotter than Frances McDormand. But, you know, I guess we'll have to make do. We'll have to make do with Frances McDormand here. She's obviously great. And, like, it's funny. I watched this movie, I don't know, a month or two ago, as I was prepping for the Washington Area Film Critics Awards. And then I didn't love it, and I still don't love it, but I do actually kind of love Frances McDormand's performance in this movie now more than I did a month ago. I think it really is. I think it actually is just about perfect. And she will handsomely deserve whatever award she gets from whoever decides to give them to her. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Nomadland?
Thumbs up, and then as soon as you can travel somewhere, just go to one of the many awesome national parks in the American West. You will be so happy.
The biggest possible thumbs up, and I am just so excited to see Chloe Zhao's career. Like, I'm so stoked for 30 years of her movies, even if they're all Marvel films.
Well, they're going to be Marvel films, and I think she's working on a Blumhouse Universal Monsters movie next, isn't she? I think I read that somewhere. Thumbs up on Nomadland. Good movie. That is it for today's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode about the attempted rehabilitation of Brett Ratner at atma.thebulwark.com. And make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences, and if we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.